From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC is supported by the Interventional Institute at Holy Name Hospital, offering non-surgical treatment options for people with inoperable or chronic conditions such as cancer, peripheral artery disease, uterine fibroids, and varicose veins. More at www.holyname.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, Google launched its Chinese website and immediately found controversy. That's because Google, along with other leading search engines, agreed to submit to Chinese censorship rules. The company defended its decision, saying the new service expands access to information for Chinese users. But not if you want information about, say, the Falun Gong or Tibet. In fact, CNETnews.com found that Google's new China search engine goes even farther than Microsoft's and Yahoo's by restricting searches on teen pregnancy, homosexuality, beer, and jokes. On Wednesday, New Jersey Republican Chris Smith, who chairs a House subcommittee on human rights, called for a hearing to examine the operating procedures of U.S. internet companies in China. It is astounding, he said, that Google, whose corporate philosophy is don't be evil, would enable evil by cooperating with China's censorship policies just to make a buck. Meanwhile, in a showdown with another government, Google is being widely praised for resisting a subpoena to turn over a week's worth of random searches. That government happens to be the United States, which, according to Columbia University professor Tim Wu, is seeking Google's search records to prove a point.
The reason they want these is it's in the context of a long-running litigation over the constitutionality of an anti-pornography law. And the government hopes to show how truly nasty the internet is and how much people are looking for pornography and how hard it is to filter this stuff to show that the internet is truly harmful to minors and therefore satisfy their constitutional burden. This is the background of a government which keeps losing on its efforts to regulate porn on the internet because of the First Amendment, and they think this might be the magic trick.
Let's put aside for a moment the question of overreaching law enforcement and invasion of privacy and illegal search and seizure and all the other constitutional issues in play here. Why in the world does Google or any other search engine save this data to begin with?
Google, if you ask them, will explain that they use those search results to improve their product. For example, if you search for Condoleezza Rice, it's sometimes hard to know exactly how you spell Condoleezza. And if you get it wrong, Google will say, well, did you mean to look for Condoleezza Rice spelled correctly? So that's an example of the kind of functionality which is made possible by keeping the search records. The question is whether that kind of functionality demands keeping your identifying information, namely your IP address. And we've seen over the last several years that IP addresses can be reliably linked to people. In other words, somewhere on these files is the potential to link every single search you've ever done with you. And I think that, frankly, scares a lot of people, including me.
There's two parties to be afraid of here, it seems to me. One is the U.S. government, which has shown an increasing interest for reasons of national security, and in this case, child welfare, to get into our business. And then there's the search engine companies themselves, Google and AOL and Microsoft and Yahoo. I know everybody was going, you go, Google, for fighting this subpoena from the Justice Department, but other search engines did cooperate, and Google and other search engine companies have also cooperated with other governments, notably China, in censoring and monitoring and ultimately suppressing speech there. Can we trust the search engine world to protect us against further incursions by this or any subsequent American administration?
In general, I don't think we can trust the search engine industry, not because they're evil, but because they have to listen to governments that ultimately have threats of physical coercion to which they are subject. One of the reasons that Google is even getting these commands from the United States government is because it's keeping these files in the first place. And so the real ethical questions for the search engine companies here are all about how vulnerable they make themselves to government's power of physical coercion. And I don't think there's been a lot of careful thinking about that problem, but as events are showing, that is the kind of thinking that's really important.
Now that people know that this data is out there, even if governments and search engines behave themselves, won't it already impinge on our freedom by simply changing the way we behave?
Freedom has a lot to do with how free you think you are. It's a psychological feeling. And I think that for a lot of people, the internet has been an important outlet in their lives, particularly search engines. You know, the idea that with typing a few terms, you can learn about anything is really rather a revolutionary idea and a kind of freedom that delivers everything the internet was supposed to. That's why I think it's time for companies like Google to step forward and say, we are going to stand for the principle of a private search. We're going to stand for an ironclad policy of never letting your search results get back to your name. We need people to be able to switch jobs, find cures for diseases, think about problems in new ways.
And even explore their own sexual perversities if they want, no?
You know, I think it's been an important outlet for people who really are considered deviants, and social policy tends to ignore them, but the outlet is the search engine. I think there's a lot of people who've been able to find out more about themselves. It's just a little piece of computer code, but for a lot of people, it's a gateway to a lot of important freedoms.
All right, Tim. Well, once again, thanks very much for joining us.
Sure.
Tim Wu is a professor at the Columbia Law School and author of Who Controls the Internet?
With Google subpoenas and NSA wiretaps in the news, the struggle begins in earnest for what has long been the privacy advocates' holy grail, online anonymity. So-called privacy geeks have long sought to create a user-friendly cloaking device that allows anyone to anonymously surf the net. The latest advance in computer cloaking was unveiled this month at a hacker convention in Washington, D.C. Quinn Norton of Wired News describes the new technology and the kind of information, personal information, it seeks to protect.
Every time you go to a website, identifying information about yourself and your computer is left there. If you're looking for a restaurant near your home address, there's nothing stopping you from putting in your home address and the kind of food you're looking for. Well, you've just blown all your anonymity right there, and most people don't realize that they've done that.
So what exactly did these hackers unveil last week?
What they'd done is put together a lot of the tools that had been available to privacy geeks into one package with a focus on making it usable for everyone. They've narrowed it down to three things, maybe four, you can do with it at all. One of them is a web browser, one of them is email, one of them is an instant messaging client.
But how does it keep other people from figuring out who you are?
They've addressed this on a lot of levels, literally from changing the way the packet looks on the internet so that an extremely advanced person in the technical field actually can't tell who you are, to just using a different default search engine that doesn't actually keep a log of your search requests like Google and AOL and MSN have.
It doesn't keep a log on your computer, but it can't prevent Google or MSN from keeping a log.
They're using a Google scraper called a Scribble that was set up by a Google Watch organization that takes Google results. It dead ends with their IP, and they dump their logs every 7 days.
I understand that the biggest hitch is that it requires you to restart your computer, to reboot it, in order to begin to use the program and establish anonymity. And, of course, a lot of people in the developing world use cyber cafes, and they don't allow you to start the machines that they're working on.
That's correct. This is their version one, and there's some plans to put together a FOB version, which would be a USB keychain that you could plug in and have probably a reduced level of anonymity off of what you could get from a complete reboot, but still something.
Anonymity on a keychain. That sounds so Philip K. Dick.
That's kind of the world we're living in these days.
Who is this application designed for? Is it designed for someone like me or for someone like a Chinese dissident or somebody who's gay in a country that can't tolerate it? Who's the ideal user?
Well, when I asked them that, they said everyone. And I think what they mean is it's not quite there yet for the Chinese dissident, but they want it to be for those people, and they want it to be for people who are interested in reestablishing privacy in the Western world, in America and Europe. Privacy they see as something for everyone.
You've written that the best hope for this software and for anonymity in general is for as many people to use it as possible for ordinary searches. Why is that? Because you'll be less noticed if everybody's using the same cloak?
That's exactly right. The more traffic there is, the less likely a government or a non-governmental agency is going to look at an encrypted packet and say, ah, you're up to something.
You know, these hackers portray themselves as altruists, but aren't there nefarious ways in which anonymity could be exploited or abused?
Absolutely. The bad people that are putting out child pornography or something right now, they're doing just fine. They're highly motivated to use the existing technologies. Making these technologies easier to use means that people who don't have as much motivation originally to guard their privacy now can really do that anyway. And the truth is about security that if you don't make it easy, people aren't going to do it.
We're always talking about China as the obvious foe in the privacy fight. But I guess we should put in a word for corporate interests who also have a lot to lose by the average online surfer, you know, going dark.
That's true. I've known one person that I talked to in the privacy debate who said that she tries to optimize for as little privacy as possible because if she's going to be shown ads, she wants them to be relevant to things she wants. And that's definitely the tension we're in. To a certain degree, we don't want a huge amount of anonymity. When I go to Amazon, I want Amazon to show me things that I want. On the other hand, when I go plug in something to a search engine that's just a random query off of the top of my head, that's not something I want to have to think about. I want that to be personal.
But Quinn, can we have it both ways? Can we both have information tailored to us based on our profiles in one sphere and complete anonymity in another? Or do we have to be expected to pay a price for making either choice?
I think that the very, very technical people that are working on this would say we can have it both ways. But it is going to be part of this continuing arms race. There's always going to be people that want to know more than we want to reveal. But we're in a situation where we can establish online identity, associate things that we want retailers to know with that identity, and then step away from it when we want to do private and personal things.
Well, Quinn, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Quinn Norton is a technology writer for Wired News.
Coming up, Hamas cleaned up in this week's Palestinian elections. Now that it's enlisted a PR consultant, can it also clean up its image?
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In this week's Palestinian election, the ruling party Fatah came in second. Hamas, a group best known in the West for deploying suicide bombers, won in a landslide. It was Hamas's first real political campaign, but it didn't run on its long-standing promise to eradicate Israel. Instead, it stumped under the slogan Reform and Change, and most agree that's why it did so well. The vote was really a message for Fatah.
It's a protest vote saying that you did very badly the last 10 years. You dragged us down into the mud. We want something else.
Marwan Abu Zalaf is editor-in-chief of Al-Quds, a leading Arab language daily published in Jerusalem. He says Fatah's long legacy of inefficiency, corruption, and cronyism has provoked widespread disgust, whereas Hamas increasingly was providing social services the Palestinian Authority did not.
They started to spend money on those projects that were neglected by the PA. And of course, poor people, when they go to a clinic and they see it funded by Mr. X or Mr. Y, they don't care as long as they get the service done.
Now a potent political force in the region, Hamas seeks to burnish its image in the West. To that end, the Guardian newspaper reported this week, Hamas has hired a media consultant named Nashat Aktash to hone its message and, said the Guardian, offer helpful hints such as don't talk about destroying Israel and don't celebrate killing people.
I was hired to facilitate some media connection, to train some people on addressing foreign media, how to say the idea, the same idea, the accurate things without changing truth.
Nashat Aktash teaches media at Birzeit University in Ramallah.
Hamas does not want to change the image. Hamas want to inform you correctly. That's it.
Did you recommend that Hamas tone down its rhetoric about, you know, pushing Israel into the sea?
No. Hamas itself removed that verse from this platform. Not because of my advice, actually.
How long ago?
In the platform of this election.
True, the group did not renew its traditional call for Israel's destruction, but it still asserts in a recently published election manifesto that, quote, historic Palestine is part of the Arabic and Islamic land, and the Palestinian right to this land has no statute of limitations. That's confusing, a confusion heightened by the multiplicity of opinions voiced by Hamas spokesmen throughout the Arab world, Al-Quds editor Marwan Abu Zalaf.
One day they say we will negotiate with Israel through a third party. The second day they say we will talk with the Israelis, but only about things that are concerning humanitarian cases. Another spokesman says another thing like we will not deal with Israel at all, they are our enemy, we have to eradicate them. They have conflicting statements. So the credibility is not strong.
After the election results came in, the European Union said it would reconsider the hundreds of millions of euros it provides in annual support to the Palestinian Authority. And President Bush declared he won't deal with Hamas until it renounces violence.
If your platform is the destruction of Israel, it means you're not a partner in peace.
For Hamas, it's a public relations puzzle, figuring out how to hold on to the foreign money while holding to its founding mission— to fight for every inch of land it claims is illegally occupied by Israel. Marwan Abu Zalaf says it's the old struggle over definitions. Are they terrorists or freedom fighters?
Some people say, what were the French doing in the Second World War against the German occupiers? The resistance.
Hamas media consultant Nashat Aktash.
I don't understand how come you accept that America itself and French people themselves remove the German occupation, and now you don't understand the meaning of 60 years of Israeli occupation over Palestine. We are not killer because we love to kill. We are fighting an occupation. Maybe in doing this, some mistakes has been done.
All this PR effort is really pathetic in my view.
Yoel Esteran is managing editor of Yediot Ahronot, Israel's largest circulation daily.
You know, Brooke, this is really an old propaganda used in the past and was never bought neither by the Israeli public nor by the international community. You know, if you want to make peace with a neighbor, you first stop, you know, shooting at him.
Esteran says that no pollster, no political analyst, no one predicted a Hamas majority.
It's an earthquake. Nobody really knows how to deal with it. We're now waiting to see what they're up to, these guys. They need to say, this is over. We're not a terrorist group anymore. We are in the government, and we declare that we stop terrorist activities. It's the burden now are on the leaders of the Hamas to show the world and Israel that they're smart enough to change their ways.
Nashat Aktash.
Even if we removed Hamas and Islamic Jihad from the map, there are 7 million Palestinians living in refugee camps in miserable situation. Each one of them could be a new Hamas. All the Palestinian fraction are saying this. We are not going to stop resistance against occupation.
Sounds like stalemate. So far, Hamas has mostly held to a ceasefire, but it has not renounced violence. Meanwhile, other groups still launch attacks, and civilians on both sides still die. So where does that leave the West, specifically Europe and the United States, the targets of this new public relations effort?
The international community is in a conundrum about how to handle things like Hamas, Hezbollah, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and so on, because all of these are the best organized political forces in their societies.
Ethan Bronner is deputy foreign editor of The New York Times.
The Western, certainly the American goal in these societies is to bring about democracy. And so it's very hard to know how to square the circle. I mean, how do you bring about democracy without allowing what some view as the serpent into the garden? And then the question is, by doing so, are you producing a moderation in these groups, or are you having, you know, one person, one vote, one time? And that's the big dilemma that's faced by American foreign policy in this question.
No matter how it's packaged, there's little chance that the nations of the West will accept Hamas's claim to kinship with the French resistance. And now that it's the ruling party, officially responsible for the Palestinian people, Marwan Abu Zalif says it makes no sense to cleave to a position that won't bring peace.
In the end of the day, if you are a government, you have to sit with them and negotiate with the Israelis. They have to be your partners. There's no way around it.
Abu Zalif says that ultimately everyone will have to come back to the table. He recalls that once the PLO was similarly cut off.
Things changed. People change, situations change, politics change, and ideologies change.
I think that the American officials looking at Hamas are fairly open-eyed about the history of this group.
Ethan Bronner.
But they also, some of them harbor hope that they can be brought into more moderate policies.
Including, perhaps, our president.
Peace is never dead because people want peace.
When the PLO assumed political power, it finally accepted the existence of Israel. It's a reality immune to image management. Political leadership is not reducible to public relations or even principle. In the 19th century, Prussian statesman Otto von Bismarck said that politics is the art of the possible. But when it comes to this conflict, perhaps a better dictum was issued in the last century by economist and diplomat John Kenneth Galbraith. He wrote, "Politics is not the art of the possible. It consists of choosing between the disastrous and the unpalatable." If Hamas wants to be a real political player, Nashat Aktash may want to revise his talking points. In what came as a total surprise to many TV industry watchers, the head honchos at UPN and the WB announced this week that they're shutting down the two networks. In their place, there will soon be just one, dubbed, in keeping with the fashion, the CW. That's C for CBS, the owner of UPN, and W for Warner Brothers, the owner of the WB. The conglomerates, tired of losing money off of these properties, concluded that by joining forces, they could more successfully attract that all-important audience, 18 to 34-year-olds. CBS chief Leslie Moonves says he's confident the formula will finally translate into profits. But it's hardly a new formula. Youth was also the target 11 years ago when the two networks were born. The only difference back then was that the target demographic wasn't simply youth, but urban youth. And that, says media scholar Crystal Brent Zook, was a strategy taken straight from the playbook of the Fox Network, itself launched in 1987.
For a long, long time, there were only three networks, the three blind mice. And people had tried to establish a fourth network, and no one was really able to do that. But Fox came along and saw that there was this urban youth niche market that wasn't being addressed, African-American, Latino, and very successfully, brilliantly, some might say, tapped into that market. You know, in the beginning it was like Married with Children and The Simpsons and those kind of shows. And then there were a lot of African-American produced shows.
But by the time UPN came along, Fox had pretty much abandoned that early mission. By 95, it was producing shows with a much wider appeal. Shows like Beverly Hills 90210, Melrose Place, Party of Five.
Right. Fox kind of abandoned the African-American urban audience anyway in 1994 when it canceled the majority of its black-produced shows, Rock and South Central and The Sinbad Show and, you know, shows that probably no one remembers now anyway because they didn't last for very long. But you have to remember that these were shows with black people behind the camera creating them and producing them and really bringing some sort of cutting-edge content.
But crossing over was a sound business strategy, right?
Right, that's true. The goal is always to cross over and to reach the mainstream audience. I think the questions came up, though, when you actually took individual shows on a case-by-case basis and looked at how well they were marketed and, you know, how much of a chance were they given to actually survive. And this is true, by the way, on all the networks. You know, they're very quick to take a black show off the air and say, well, it's not good business, it's not successful, whereas some other shows, they'll give them more time, they'll give them more space to find their audience.
On the other hand, statistics show us what African Americans watch and what white Americans watch are very different things, that they don't seem to enjoy watching each other all that much.
But black viewers and white viewers, what they have in common is that they both watch integrated programming. So, for example, the one-hour dramas, CSI and Law & Order and all that, they actually have a really high African-American viewership, just as much as, you know, the white viewership.
So it's that simple. Integrate the programs, and you'll integrate the audience.
Well, yeah, and in particular, they've done a good job of that with dramas for some reason. But when it comes to comedy, they've sort of ghettoized and kept separate this idea of black comedies. And it's strange also that we've never really had a successful black drama.
So what do you think went wrong for UPN, or for that matter, the WB? Why couldn't they do what Fox ultimately was able to do?
UPN and the WB tried initially some of that same strategy in targeting the urban market, but you had so many different interests competing for this same small market. I think it was timing. And it was also, I think, lack of imagination and daring on the part of the fifth and sixth networks. You know, they copycatted Fox in a way, but they didn't ever even do it with the same innovation and the same daring that Fox did initially.
So you're shedding no tears for UPN and the African-American sitcoms that it supported?
I mean, personally, I don't see it as much of a loss either way. You know, it's kind of like when BET was sold to Viacom and people said, oh, it's the loss of a black-owned network. Oh, this is awful. And, you know, my thing was, well, BET never behaved much like a black-owned network anyway in terms of any interest in deeper social issues in its programming.
So when Les Moonves says the new network will remain committed to, quote, minority audiences, should we take him at his word or just assume it will be business as usual?
Well, for the most part, that's what it's been up to now. You know, there's a huge difference between a show like Everybody Loves Chris, which is fine, it's entertainment, but there's a huge difference between that and a show like South Central, which was on Fox, that tackled questions about gang violence and black and Latino relations and unemployment and single motherhood. I mean, it was a comedy or a dramedy that actually tried to be relevant.
You know, it strikes me that the kind of program you're describing, South Central, probably requires a different business model and a different set of initials. And the initials I'm thinking of are HBO.
HBO has done a fabulous job. You know, they understand that they have a higher percentage, a disproportionate percentage of African-American viewers. But they've chosen to address that viewer in a way that goes much deeper. And some people could say, well, they're able to do that because they're HBO. But I think that Fox was able to do it. The WB could have done it. UPN could have done it. You know, I don't see why not.
Crystal, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Brooke. It's my pleasure.
Crystal Brentz-Zook is an adjunct professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. She's the author of Color by Fox, The Fox Network, and The Revolution in Black Television. Her new book, Black Women's Lives, hits bookstores next month.
And now a couple of updates. In October, we reported on the federal prosecution of two pro-Israel lobbyists. The men are accused, essentially, of passing on classified information to journalists that was given to them by a Pentagon staffer. Last week, a judge sentenced that staffer, Larry Franklin, to 12 years in prison for his role in the leak. But thanks to the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, we learned this week that Judge T.S. Ellis III dropped another bombshell at the hearing. And I quote, "Persons who have unauthorized possession, who come into unauthorized possession of classified information, must abide by the law. That applies to academics, lawyers, journalists, professors, whatever." In other words, it is a crime, in this judge's view, merely to possess government secrets, even if you are, say, a newspaper reporter working on an investigative scoop, or, we suppose, a newspaper reader who happens to come across that scoop in the newspaper. At a minimum, it doesn't bode well for the lobbyists themselves, who are scheduled to go on trial in Ellis's courtroom in April. And a little addendum to our interview earlier this month with New York Times business reporter Timothy O'Brien, who said that the Forbes 400 list of the richest Americans is flawed. Exhibit A, in his view, the spotty research he says it does on Donald Trump. O'Brien told us that mostly Forbes just takes Trump's word on his net worth, and Trump is prone to hyperbole.
Trump is, you know, a top-tier smoke and mirrors man. In the popular imagination, if people think Donald Trump is a billionaire, Donald Trump can then tour the country telling people how they can become billionaires just like him. And investors can be lazy. And if they think someone has credibility, they'll go ahead and buy the stock.
On Tuesday, we learned that Trump is suing the reporter and his publisher, contending that O'Brien's book has cost him lost deals and injury to reputation. O'Brien alleged Trump isn't close to being a billionaire. If Trump proves otherwise, he's seeking another $5 billion in damages to go on top of what he already has.
Coming up, the Pope gets into the copyright racket and the truth about real and fake presidents. They're all mortal in the end.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Pope Benedict issued his first encyclical on Wednesday. If you read it in a newspaper, it's because the Vatican says the press can publish the Pope's words as news. However, as of this week, if you'd like to use a portion of the encyclical or any other papal text in a book you're working on, get ready to pay up, because quoting the Pope just got pricey. The Vatican Publishing House will henceforth impose copyright fees To explain, we welcome John Allen, Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. John, welcome to OTM.
Hi, Bob.
This one took me by surprise. Charging to reprint the Pope's words, where did that come from?
In theory, this has always been the case. I mean, the Vatican has always asserted a copyright over papal documents. The difference is they're now actually starting to charge for these things, which they've never done in the past. What's happened is that a couple of fairly high-profile Italian journalists who did books either about the previous pope or the current one, their publishing houses have received fairly hefty bills, in one case 15,000 euro, which of course would be almost $18,000, for using extensive portions of texts written by the pope either before his election or now. This has caused tumult around the Vatican because, of course, in theory, the Vatican exists to get the pope's message out, that is, to make sure that the word is spread throughout the world. It has caught some people off guard that they now want people to pay for that privilege.
And also, forgive me, but my understanding is that the Pope, according to Catholic orthodoxy, is essentially God's proxy on earth, in which case it sounds like God is charging royalties. Am I overstating
yeah,
that?
Well, I mean, look, I mean, the reality is from a strictly commercial point of view, there's nothing particularly strange here. I mean, even, you know, mid-list authors such as myself, if people want to use extensive excerpts from my books, they've got to pay Random House for the privilege of doing so. I think the surprising thing is simply that this is not, you know, General Motors or this is not Bertelsmann, but this is the Holy See. And therefore, a lot of people think that the kind of ordinary commercial rules shouldn't apply. My observation about the Catholic Church is that there are often kind of two impulses that just don't go well with one another. I mean, one is the evangelical impulse of wanting to give away everything because that's the nature of grace. The other is the realistic institutional logic. They, like everybody else, have to pay a light bill. And I think this is one of those cases where those two tendencies just sort of sit in an uneasy coexistence with one another.
Now, in addition to being the pontiff, the pope is also the head of state of the Vatican. And if our head of state, President Bush, delivered, say, the State of the Union speech, for example, it could be picked up by any author at any time in perpetuity and published without any copyright liability because he is, you know, essentially on the government payroll, and whoever wrote the speech is on the government payroll, and it belongs to all of us. Why do the Pope's words not belong to all of us, or in any event, all Catholics?
Well, I think that's a very good question. And, you know, and the practical reality is that this decree is going to have to be interpreted through the copyright laws of every nation where the Pope's words are heard. So I'm not exactly sure what the enforceability of this would be. I really think the primary sort of target, so to speak, are publishers in Italy. There is a whole cottage industry in this country of taking papal documents and repackaging them and selling them. If you walked into a bookstore in Rome, you would find five or six competing editions of the Pope's new encyclical. And in that kind of Wild West environment, I think the Vatican is attempting to assert some kind of control over who gets to piggyback, if you like, on the Pope's speech. On the other hand, you're quite right that the Pope is, in a sense, a public figure, and that his words are, in effect, directed to all Catholics everywhere. To some extent, I suppose all Catholics everywhere would feel like they have a right to hear what the Pope has to say. Probably also worth adding that, you know, the Vatican is not a multinational corporation. It has an annual budget of about $270 million. And every year, they struggle to make ends meet. There aren't too many opportunities for them to find additional revenue streams, and I think probably one of the bean counters in the Vatican figured this was one of the few opportunities they had.
All right, John. Many thanks.
Glad to help.
John Allen is the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. Vice President Dick Cheney has never been accused of being a fashionista, but careful watchers of the news have occasionally spotted the Veep looking even more haphazard than usual. There was the Auschwitz Holocaust Memorial event where Cheney dressed as if he'd been out snowblowing, and more recently he's been wearing noticeably inappropriate footwear. First, mismatched shoes, including one moccasin at a military medal ceremony, and then scuffed casual brown Oxfords to match his dark gray suit for a visit with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. It could be second-term indifference, but more likely, many have speculated, it's the telltale sign of an older man with heart disease, accommodating his health. And if the press is forced to read his footwear as if they were tea leaves, it's only because he and most executive branch officials have never been entirely forthcoming about their fitness. It's a cat-and-mouse game as old as the presidency. Robert Gilbert is a presidential historian and the author of The Mortal Presidency, Illness and Anguish in the White House. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So in your pantheon of presidents who were sicker than the public was then led to believe, who would be members?
Oh, my gosh. Many of them. John Adams, the second president, left the Capitol for about 6 months trying to overcome what seemed to be an emotional breakdown. Now researchers believe it was hypothyroidism. James Madison was delirious for a period of time, about 3 weeks, wasn't able to function as president. Grover Cleveland was diagnosed as having cancer of the jaw. And he said, if Congress finds out, my relationship with Congress will be even worse than it is now. And so he boarded a yacht with five physicians, and the yacht traveled slowly up the Hudson River while the physicians removed his upper jaw. And 2 weeks later, doctors engaged in a second surgery and fitted him with an artificial rubber jaw so that he would be able to speak. And we didn't find this out until about 10 years after his death, when one of the doctors published an account of this surgery.
Not very observant reporters, it seems to me.
Reporters did ask White House officials whether or not the rumors were true that Cleveland had been operated on. And the White House simply told them that the president had had a tooth removed.
What's the history of the press, either soft peddling or through some sort of conspiracy of silence, actually suppressing bad news about presidential health?
I think the press in the Roosevelt years did cooperate in concealing the president's health, at least the fact that he had lost the use of his legs. Roosevelt told the press that he never wanted to be photographed being lifted out of his limousine. He told the press that he never wanted to be photographed seated in his wheelchair. And by and large, the press respected his wishes. And also, I think many reporters at the time were convinced that there's no reason why someone who doesn't have the use of his legs can't be an effective president.
There's one fabulous story in the history of presidential health and the disclosure thereof. It concerned Lyndon Johnson, who underwent gallbladder surgery in the middle of his presidency. Tell me about that.
It was in 1965, recuperating at his Texas ranch. He was talking to the press one day, and needless to say, they were asking questions about the gallbladder surgery, and all of a sudden Johnson opened his jacket and lifted his shirt to show the scar. And many people thought that this was really vulgar and very uncouth. But in point of fact, there was a reason why Johnson did this. Johnson, when he was Senate Majority Leader, had had a massive heart attack, had almost died, as a matter of fact. And he lifted his shirt and showed the scar because he was trying to dispel rumors that he had had another heart attack.
In the early days of the Republic, the press was very different than it is now. It was very partisan. Were reporters more or less vigilant in that environment than they are now under the largely objective press?
Well, I don't think the modern press is particularly vigilant when it comes to the president's health. For example, when President Bush supposedly fainted a few years ago after eating a pretzel and choking on a pretzel, the press basically accepted that explanation. But there certainly have been intimations by some doctors that the president might, in point of fact, have certain health problems. One problem that I've heard is that he might have the same condition that his father had, atrial fibrillation, and might actually be wearing an electrical device to monitor his heart and shock his heart back into normal rhythm if it goes out of rhythm.
That might explain that strange box-shaped hump under the president's shirt during one of the debates that was the subject of some speculation a year and a half ago.
Yes.
The public has shown sometimes that it is willing to put up with various White House white lies. Do you think the president's health is an issue that they've accepted the administration not to be forthcoming about?
I think the public tends to see the president as sort of a heroic figure, not completely human. In other words, not being susceptible to the same kind of illnesses that the rest of us are susceptible to. And also, I think some portion of the public would see this as a privacy issue, that the president has a right to keep his medical records private.
All right, Bob, thanks very much.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Robert Gilbert is a professor of political science at Northeastern University and author of Mortal Presidency, Illness and Anguish in the White House.
Presidential pretzels aside, we haven't faced a major White House health crisis in a good many years. But for devoted viewers of The West Wing, a fictional crisis is bad enough. TV president Jeb Bartlett suffers from MS and probably kept his degenerative condition far too long from the American people. But fans faced a different kind of loss this week when NBC announced that after 7 years, The West Wing will end in May. From the start, The West Wing was unusual network fare, the dialogue a little faster, the characters a little smarter than nearly anything else on the air. James Poniewozik writes about TV for Time magazine. He says that in 1999, when The West Wing first hit the small screen, the conventional wisdom was that politics just doesn't play as a subject for mass market drama.
Politics is polarizing. I mean, I think this all goes back to the vaunted and I think now outdated notion of LOP, least objectionable programming.
Right.
That is, if you're a big TV network, you want to provide viewers with as few reasons as possible to change the channel. Well, if you're doing a show about politicians that has any actual politics in it, at some point, somebody has to say what party they're in, and they have to take a stand on issues that people get mad about in real life. And, you know, the thinking is, well, you're doing a show about, you know, a Democratic administration. You've lost half the audience. I think that that turned out not to be true. Because, in fact, I think that while The West Wing is certainly Democratic wish fulfillment, I think it's also a nonpartisan wish fulfillment in a way, in that a lot of its storylines are really simply about the wish for politicians who take stands on principles.
President, I got to tell you something, and you're not going to like the sound of it.
What?
He's right, and we're wrong.
About what?
About the ethanol tax.
Mr. President, Leo's right.
Sam's weighing in.
Sir, I put McCambridge, Aiello, and Dane in a headlock to vote our way. Let's send them back. We'll lose 53-47, and we'll take the vice president off the hook.
All right, let's do what Sam said.
Well, it was launched during the Clinton administration, and I guess it was supposed to be somewhat based on it. I know there were a lot of TV producers and writers hanging around the Clinton White House, but it wasn't really supposed to be the Clinton White House, right?
It wasn't exactly supposed to be the Clinton White House. And ironically, you know, back then in 1999, part of the wish fulfillment element was that it was an idealized Clinton White House, one in which there was more honesty. I remember in the first season, Aaron Sorkin talking about how he once wanted to do a scene, which I think he never actually did, in which an intern propositioned Martin Sheen in the Oval Office. And, you know, Martin Sheen told her something like, you know, if you ever tried to do that again, you'll be fired. In other words, it was in many ways, frankly, a critique of what was then the sitting Democratic administration.
We have a $32 billion budget surplus for the first time in 3 decades.
Yes.
Republicans in Congress want to use this money for tax relief, right?
Yes.
Essentially what they're saying is we want to give back the money.
Yes.
Why don't we want to give back the money?
Because we're Democrats.
But it's not the government's money.
Sure it is. It's right there in our bank account.
That's only because we collected more money than we ended up needing.
Isn't it great?
I want my money back.
Sorry.
You know, after you heard that the show was canceled, you wrote that you hoped that it would end with Bartlett and his team cleaning out their desks, ready to hand the baton over to a Republican president. Why do you hope that?
I think it makes dramatic sense. One thing that I think has been a flaw of the show is that purposely it has been a little too easy on its protagonists in the Bartlett White House. So I think it would be a plausible and dramatically rewarding change for the show to, you know, have the characters face being turned out of office in favor of another party and to look back on, well, what have we accomplished over 8 years and what have we done right and what have we done wrong?
Obviously, we cover the Washington Press Corps in real life on this show. And so I've always been interested in how the West Wing portrays the press and the administration's relationship with the press. Is that just me, or do you think that those storylines are compelling for everybody?
One thing that I think is probably interesting to the lay viewer is the fact that the White House press spokesperson can often be strategically kept in the dark and even willingly kept in the dark. There are often these questions of, you know what, don't tell me about that because I can't tell the press corps about this, and I don't want to have to lie, so don't let me know too much about this information that I can't disclose. I think it sometimes portrays the Washington press corps as interested in superficiality and, you know, personalities and gotcha stories and things like that. All of which is entirely true.
I was waiting for that.
But it's often a function of the fact that the White House press corps lives this, you know, sort of hermetic environment in which they have a very difficult time getting actual information out of the administration. So what else are you going to write about?
You know, a lot of White House insiders who have been involved with the show have been quoted over the years regarding the impact of the West Wing. Lawrence O'Donnell, who is one of the show's executive producers and is one of those former Washington insiders, said he knew the show was making a cultural impact when he found that politicians who rarely watch TV were fans.
I think it was taken fairly seriously in the political community for the way it laid out actual real political issues. I mean, as a critic, I thought the show could often be a little preachy, a little didactic. On the other hand, you know, I have to give it credit. It would do storylines about the census and redistricting, and I think it deserved respect for that.
The census has to be taken seriously.
Tell me about it.
You know, it's not glamorous, but, you know?
Sure.
You need something?
Did you get a haircut?
So do you think you'll miss it?
You know, I will miss it. There are certain shows, and West Wing is one of those for me, that because they're so ambitious, even when I haven't liked them, they provide just a rich level of things to criticize about. You know, it can be more rewarding for me to be mad at the West Wing than it is to enjoy a show that is one-fifth as ambitious.
So as we look ahead, we have Gina Davis, who plays the first woman president and commander-in-chief. Who would you prefer for president, Gina Davis or Martin Sheen?
I got to go with Gina Davis because I'm pretty sure she's taller. And the taller candidate just always seems more authoritative, don't they?
It didn't seem to work for Kerry.
Oh, well, there's always the exception that proves the rule.
Okay, James, thanks a lot.
Okay, bye.
James Poniewozik is the TV critic for Time Magazine.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Vallo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had engineering help from Rob Christensen and other assistants from Katie Holt and Kevin Schlottman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR. Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at wnyc.org. And thanks.